The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning. So I'd like to talk about what's called a factor of awakening. In our tradition of meditation practice, there are seven psychological functionings that come into play as the practice deepens, and these seven are called the seven factors of awakening. And the second one is called the factor of, usually in English, is called factor of investigation. And it follows the first, which is mindfulness. And the idea is the two work together. Mindfulness is kind of the foundation, and based on that foundation, then there can be investigation. And there are many ways of understanding this factor of investigation. When I was in Burma, it was emphasized quite a bit in, with language of penetrating investigation, to really look deeply into something, to use the mindful, not just be present for something, but to kind of look through it or deeply into it. What's really here? And one of the things that I learned through that kind of penetrating investigation was how much of my experience, I think much of our experience, is mediated through abstract concepts. And that as we begin to look more carefully, what we penetrate is the concepts of things, so we can see more deeply what's actually happening below the concepts that we overlay on our experience. But this word, that the Pali word for, in, that's translated as investigation, has another meaning. And I kind of like these days the other and more literal meaning of it. It means to distinguish or differentiate. And what that helps me with, at least, is that investigation too easily implies a kind of probing or even analysis of our experience. Try to kind of really analyze it deeply, what's actually going on. Be an investigator, you know, detective of the Dharma. The literal meaning, the word is vichaya, and vichaya more literally means to differentiate or distinguish. And what's said to distinguish is dharmas. And probably the best, possible the best translation for this technical word dharmas is things. Differentiate things or states or what's kind of what's differentiated, what's going on here. And so part of the function of mindfulness practice is to bring forth our capacity to make better and better distinctions between what's going on here. So we don't see things in the abstract, but see things in the particularity of what's actually happening in the moment. So mindfulness itself also has different meanings of how it's practiced. Mindfulness is the practice of using our attention to, or engaging our intention, so that attention is really present for our present moment experience. And how attention is used for that purpose can vary from situation to situation. Different people find different uses of attention most useful for them. For some people, what's most helpful is directed attention. Someone tells them, pay attention to the breath, they just turn their attention directed at the breath, and they just stay there. And that works really well for them. Other people, the idea of directed attention doesn't work so well, partly because it's maybe there's too much self in the effort, too much expectation, like I have to succeed, I have something to do here, and they bring a lot of doing into it, and the very doing of it stirs things up. And actually, sometimes people tie themselves in knots and trying to do too much. And so rather than directing attention, some people find it much more helpful to not do, to undo. Rather than doing attention, they mostly practice letting go of the distractions, letting go of the preoccupations that interfere with the natural functioning of awareness. That awareness is something that we're always doing, we're pretty much always aware. Some people would say that there's a certain kind of awareness operating even in sleep. But there's awareness is always happening, and as some of you know, I've done this regularly here, that I like this exercise where I get to tell you to stop paying attention. just stop being aware. Cut it out. And what happens to some people is that if you tell them to pay attention, they try heroically. They keep, the mind wanders off, they come back, and they keep trying and trying. And as soon as you tell them to stop and just cut it out completely, they can't help but be aware. It just operates in spite of themselves, because there's a natural functioning of our perceptual processes are always operating to some degree, and so we're aware. So rather than having directed attention, some people find it helpful to have the language of allow attention, get out of the way of awareness, of mindfulness, and let it just kind of surface, arise from within in a kind of holistic way. The directed attention, the first type, as I said, works very well for some people, but it has a little shadow side or difficult side sometimes, and that is it's easy to divide our lives between what we think we should pay attention to and what we shouldn't pay attention to. Divide our life between the doer and what's being done or what's being done to. And so it can reinforce for some people the tendency to live divided lives, fragmented lives, to have very sharp separation between self and other, self and activity. And in that sharp divide, there can be a lot of suffering. The kind of awareness that we allow awareness to surface, we kind of get out of the way, it tends not to divide so much. It tends not to create an awareness where we're separate from our experience, but rather it's more holistic, and that allows whatever is occurring to arise in that open field of awareness. And so that allows for, things are included and rather than not excluded. The directed attention can sometimes exclude. The allowing awareness can include everything. The downside of the allowing awareness is that it's sometimes way too easy to let the mind perpetuate a certain kind of indulgence or addiction to thinking and so rather than letting thinking kind of get quiet, the thinking just barrels, continues uninterrupted because we're just allowing everything to be there. But it's not so helpful. I've known people who spend maybe a long time thinking they were meditating. It was mostly they weren't being mindful, they were being thoughtful and just kind of thinking they just allow things to be, and they just allowed their thinking to gallop ahead. So there are, both sides have their pluses and their minuses. But they're different ways. In different times in people's meditation life, different approaches are useful, sometimes more the directed, sometimes more the allowing. But the point is that not so much which way is right or wrong, but rather to come to an ability to no longer have the mind distracted from the present moment, to no longer be spending a lot of time in fantasy, a lot of time thinking about the future, a lot about the past, or a lot of time caught up in discursive thinking, analyzing the situation in a very discursive way. And so the function of mindfulness is to get us into this place, and many people find that being present in this way is relaxing, is calming, because a lot of the stresses of our life, agitation of our life, comes from the mind being overly busy, caught up in its concerns and activities and worries. And so there's something about, for many people, of coming into the present moment where our worries don't exist, that things quiet down and the mind becomes quieter. Another way of referring to that is that the mind becomes clear. And part of the function of mindfulness practice is to cultivate a clear seeing, a clear mind that can see clearly what's here. So the analogy could be that, I'm nearsighted, and if I take my glasses off, I could say that I see. I can see, but I don't see much. I mean, I can tell there's a sea of people out there. I actually can't see your faces. Maybe I can see Chris's face, but kind of. I think she has glasses on. further than that, it's like just the face has become just this blur of color. And And so, you know, I'm not seeing clearly. But if I put on my glasses, then I now I can see clearly. Now I can see what I couldn't see before. And I can distinguish people, different people. And I can distinguish not only people, but I can distinguish different aspects of all of you. I can notice that you have eyes and nose and mouth, which I kind of didn't only knew because of memory when I had my glasses off. It was just this blur of color. And it's useful to distinguish these different aspects. It's useful to distinguish different qualities of what goes on around you. I can notice your facial expressions. I can notice, you know, different things about you. If I can notice, you know, your eyes or your nose or your mouth or, you know, what's going on or your gestures, what's happening. And so the ability to see clearly allows us to distinguish. And this is a very important part of human life, the ability to distinguish, differentiate what's happening. And part of the function of mindfulness meditation is to get us to a place of practice where the mind naturally will start making clearer distinctions or differentiations of what's happening in the moment. Not because we're analyzing it, but because just like putting on the glasses, it becomes pretty straightforward to see these distinctions. And why that's helpful for us is that when we are abstract about our life, when we, you know, life is very complicated. I like to think of human life as being an individual life, let alone our social life, as a very complicated ecosystem of many, many factors, social, interpersonal, psychological, emotional, historical, many things come together. And it can just seem like a buzzing swirl of activity that just seems kind of like confusing. We don't quite understand. And the Buddhist tradition kind of holds that one of the problems with suffering is that human suffering tends to be confusing. People don't really see clearly what's happening when they're under a lot of stress, when there's a lot of distress, when there's a lot of sorrow or grief. And so it's just confusing to understand what's going on here. There was an article today, I read it in the BBC News, about teenagers in Northern Ireland. And they said that 10% of teenagers in Northern Ireland have contemplated harming themselves, suicide or cutting themselves or something. And the study considered that the reason for that is that there's a lot of stresses in their lives. And it's a way of dealing, I don't know if dealing's the right word, with their stresses. But they can't differentiate between what stresses are fed to them from society, and so they think they're to blame. And so there's kind of a self-criticism that's part of that wanting to hurt themselves. But what they need to be taught, I suppose, is that we live in a society where the society has a lot of demands on people, a lot of stress. I don't know if it's still the case, but 10 years ago there was a book about high school students in Palo Alto and talked about the tremendous stresses they were under for success and how some of these high school students back then were taking speed and different kinds of drugs in order to really stay up on top of their studies and really kind of progress and get along. This book talked about how much stress these students were under. I can see that with my son who's in high school. And when I compare it to my high school days, I mean, it was really relaxed. You know, college? What's college? There wasn't much concern about, you know, that was the impression I got. I mean, it's my, you know, for me, and do well in high school, I mean, no one was watching. And there wasn't very much demand. My son, can't hear out there? Can other people hear out there? You can hear out there. You might want to use the hearing system device if you can't hear, because I don't know if most people out there can hear. Okay. I think my son is getting a much better high school education than I got. And now I look back at my education and point, boy, I hardly learned anything. And I missed a lot of classes. But my son, he's getting a very good education, but I can see that he's under a lot of, stress is the right word, but he works really hard. He gets tired from all the work he does. And so the idea of success, of getting into a good college and all this stuff that some teens live under, it's stressful. And some of these messages come from society and family. This is what you have to do. And so what this study in Northern Ireland said that rather than understanding the stresses come from society, the values of society around them, they blame themselves. And in that blaming, they suffer, right? So there's an example where the researchers or the psychologists would like to help the teens differentiate the sources of their stress that they're under, to understand where it comes from, and understand what goes on in our society. It's confusing, they don't understand, and then the confusion, some people blame themselves. Some people do the opposite. They're under a lot of stress and a lot of pain, and what they do is they blame everyone else, blame others. And that's what they're good at doing. And, you know, that's a coping mechanism. And so when the mind gets quiet and be able to see clearly, we start seeing what the details of what's going on, the particulars of what's going on. And that differentiation is very helpful. Not only is it helpful, but in Buddhist tradition says it's liberating, it can free us, because we see where the freedom is in the situation. And it also offers a tremendous power, personal power, to see clearly, understand what's going on. So there's many things that get differentiated. So a very simple one that we say is we differentiate an experience and our reaction to it as being two separate things. So if there's a lot of traffic noise happening while we're meditating, and the traffic, yesterday we were meditating here and there were a lot of banging across the street. They were doing construction work during our meditation. So the banging is what's happening. But our reaction is distinct. And I've been in meditation situations where there was terrible noises that should not happen in a meditation center. Absolutely not. And those noises were interfering with my meditation practice. Don't they realize that I'm on the brink of some great breakthrough, and you know my precious meditation? It's so important. And who are these people who are not paying attention, being disrespectful? And if someone needs to talk to these disrespectful people, and don't they realize how important I am in my meditation? And it's all about them and that noise. But my reaction is distinct from the noise. And I've actually gone full circle sometimes. I don't know if full circle is the right word, but come to the other side, where I eventually saw my reaction to the noise and was able to put down my reaction, and the same noise continued. It was just noise. And in fact, sometimes the noise became my friend because it helped me stay in the present moment. Turned out I wasn't so good at being in the present moment, and my mind would drift off, bang, bang, oh, be present. Like the mindfulness hammer, bang, bang. And I came to appreciate it, rather than, you know, this whole story about my meditation and how it's interfering with me. So to sit quietly and begin to tease apart the experience and the reaction is important. Also, within the reaction, to begin teasing apart the different aspects of it, to distinguish between, for example, what's emotional, the emotional response, from the beliefs that are operating, and to see, oh, there's a belief here, my meditation, how important it is, and so, you know, and the emotion is maybe one of distress at first, or one of anger or indignation, to see these are two different things. Which of them has priority? Where do I bring my attention to? What makes the most difference to really notice? And then if you kind of stay present and watch that differentiate, then at some point you start seeing that there's a place of choice. And the place of choice is sometimes very hard to see. But the whole Buddhist enterprise has a lot to do with allowing, letting things be, becoming quiet, letting reality show itself, trusting reality in a certain way, the unfolding of it, trusting the Dharma, but so that we can see clearly until such a point where we see where we have a choice. At some point we know, and it's, it can be quite surprising to see the place where there was a sound, there was a thought, this is interfering with my meditation. And then there was a choice, do I pick that thought up? Do I get involved in it, or do I leave it alone? And you see, oh, it's just a thought. And the ability to differentiate a thought as just a thought, to see it clearly, oh, it's a thought, it can be phenomenally significant event, because then you can be wise about that thought. But if you don't see a thought as a thought, which I think in ordinary life, it's probably fair to say, that we don't clearly see a thought as just a thought. Thoughts are important. Thoughts are alive. Some people, I am because I think. It's inconceivable that you could even exist if you weren't thinking. And some people are frightened to let go of their thoughts because they're so closely identified with it. And so we're involved so much that we don't see it as thoughts. The example I gave yesterday was, I think twice in the many years I've lived here in the peninsula. I don't know what has to do with this particular exit, but there's an exit on 280, it's the Page Mill exit, going south. And I was happily driving along, and I was supposed to get off at Page Mill, and I missed the exit. I was driving safely enough, I was paying attention, but I was, involved in some kind of thought that was more interesting than the exit. And it's kind of consequential at that exit, because the next exit is far away. El Monte is kind of a little bit far. So, I didn't know it just thought was a thought. I was living in the thought. I was caught up in the thought. I was perpetuating the thinking. Which, it's appropriate enough sometimes. But when there's really a lot of clear seeing, we see a thought is just a thought. And then we can just leave it alone. We see the place of choice. Or you see an emotion as just an emotion. Not to dismiss it or belittle it, but rather so that we can just maybe respect it and leave it alone. Most emotions, I think it's useful to see most emotions as byproducts, as rather than something primary. As byproducts, the cause and conditions come together, and there's an emotional response that happens to a situation. And we don't have to see it as good or bad as long as we don't act on some of them. But to see it, today I am grumpy. I'm not grumpy, but to see, oh, there's grumpiness or irritation. It's just irritation. It's there because of causes and conditions. And to see it clearly helps us then avoid being fooled by the lens of irritation. And, so we see that we're a little bit more careful then when we go around the world. We don't assume automatically that how we see things is true when everyone's irritating us. So it's just irritation. It's a byproduct. You're not wrong or bad for having it, these byproducts, but you are responsible for what you do next. So this is the place of choice. So you can see, oh, there's irritation. I just leave it alone, or I'll be careful, or I'll tell my friends, warn them. This is what's happening, you should know. And because you see it for what it is. And then maybe you don't say the things that come out of the irritation, because you see those as just, see for what they are. So investigation, one of the meanings for this Dhamma Vichaya, is to make better and better distinctions, better and better differentiations. It becomes skillful in this capacity. And actually the English word skill, I believe, in its Germanic kind of roots of the word, means to differentiate, to separate out. You can see that some of them who's really good at a skill, they get better and better and finer refined distinctions about how to do their skills. Like someone who's a swimmer, it's pretty easy to swim. You just kind of flop your arms around. and you put your arm in front of you, and then you push it, pull it through the water, and you know. But the better and better swimmer you are, very, very refined little distinctions are noticed that support and kind of make the swimming better and better. So this idea of being able to distinguish and differentiate becomes important. And a swimmer who pays a lot of attention is very clear, starts noticing all these little distinctions and how they're consequential over time. So meditation practice, mindfulness meditation practice, does have an important component of relaxation. But a lot of people overemphasize the relaxing quality of meditation as if they kind of lull themselves into deeper and deeper calm, partly because it's a nice antidote to being a stressed out life. It's a relief to have it. But we don't want to overemphasize relaxation in this tradition, as important as it is. But we also remember that an important quality is this quality to see clearly, and in seeing clearly, to make distinctions, to make differentiations. And I would propose that our ability to make distinctions is also allows us to respect things much more carefully. And that's true for the people you encounter. To see everyone as the same has a certain wisdom, but it also misses the particularity of people. And to be able to distinguish people by their particularity is a foundation for, I think, real genuine respect for people. All the differences, individual, familial, cultural, ethnic, all the different ways that people are different from each other. I think, and it's possible then to, you know, respect, to appreciate, to celebrate differences if we see the distinctions that are there. Same thing within us. The better distinctions we can make within us of all the different factors going on, become wise at how our mind works, thoughts, feelings, emotions, beliefs, and it's possible to respect all this. And I'd like to posit, I'd like to believe, that mindfulness practice is a practice of very profound respect for every possible thing that we encounter. That respect doesn't mean that we condone it. It doesn't mean that we just continue doing certain things. But everything's respected. Everything is given a second look. Everything's allowed to be as it is. And as we respect and allow things to be, then we also find a place of choice. And more we find there's a place of choice where we can be free. And that place of freedom is the place where suffering comes to an end. So just like with mindfulness, sometimes mindfulness is directed, and sometimes it's more something that's allowed to happen. Same thing with this factor of investigation or differentiation. Sometimes we intentionally take our attention and look more carefully to really see what's here, to begin differentiating, teasing apart. And sometimes we don't make any directed efforts to do that, but we allow the mind to get quieter and more open and present, and then allow the differentiations to show themselves. And what's nice about the second way of getting quiet, not making so much work about analyzing or investigating, just allowing the differences to show themselves over time, is that it's very respectful because reality might know better what you need to pay attention to than you do. So if you direct it, you might think you know what needs to be done, but the reality probably has a better idea what's needed. And so we allow to let it show itself. And finally, in the Buddhist tradition, in this Vipassana tradition that we're in, as the practice opens up to these better and better distinctions, differentiations, there's a couple of key ones. We start differentiating suffering and the cause of suffering, and we start differentiating the arising and passing of things. Start seeing that things arise, they occur, and they pass away. Seeing the impermanence, the changing nature of things, is supported a lot by being able to see distinctions. If we see abstract concepts, they don't change so much. We get through the abstract concept to see clearly what's here. then we can see impermanence. And this, the distinctions of impermanence is one that's also said to be freeing. I wanted to read a story, and then I'll stop, really. So this is from my book, A Monastery Within. After lunch one day, the abbess and a visiting philosophy professor went for a walk along the river that passed by the monastery. Being a hot day, they eventually sat down to cool off under the shade of a large tree. The professor asked, "I am interested in learning Buddhist philosophy. Could you tell me some of the fundamental doctrines of your religion?" "Well," said the abbess, "I don't think I can help you much. You see, we don't rely on philosophy at the monastery." "But," continued the professor, "everyone, consciously or unconsciously, has a philosophy with which to make sense of their life and their purpose." "It is different in the monastery," replied the abbess. "At the monastery, we rely on awareness, not doctrines." "But," insisted the professor, "you must have a philosophy which explains the importance of being aware." After pausing to consider how best to respond, the abbess said, "As we walked along, we were both aware of how hot, sweaty, and tired we'd become from our walk. We did not need a philosophy to tell us the benefits of sitting down here in the shade. If you put your hand on a hot stove, you don't need a philosophy to pull the hand away. If a baby is crying from hunger, the need to feed the child is obvious to the parent. Buddhist practice does not depend on having a set of doctrines or beliefs. Rather, it depends on being aware of what brings release from suffering. Rather than being taught Buddhist philosophy, at the monastery, the monks and nuns are trained to develop an acutely refined awareness. With such sensitivity, ultimate liberation is as natural as sitting down in the shade on a hot day." So with greater awareness, there's greater sensitivity. And then the differentiation, the distinctions we make, show us that liberation is as natural as taking a rest on a hot day. May all of you rest well. So we have a few minutes before we end. Maybe you can take a time, if someone has one question maybe, and if you'd like to ask. And it'd be nice if you say your name so we get familiar with each other's names.
Yes, my name is Dennis. So we had Tom Jeff here for a full day, I think it was about a month ago, a few weeks ago. And there was the jackhammer going on across the street. And I chuckled because I remember when I was in, we weren't able to go on retreat in Burma at the time because of the uprising that was going on. So we had the retreat in Thailand at a Burmese monastery. And right in front, they had jackhammers. And I'm thinking, I'm going through all the machinations that you were mentioning, like how could they set this retreat up now and during the time when they're remodeling the front and, you know, da-da-da-da-da. So eventually I had to choose to just be with what was there. And it was really interesting because after about a week, and it was intermittent, it wasn't like it was going constantly, but if you focused on it and made it an issue, it could be a very uncomfortable retreat. So I was just trying to be with it, and within a week, they did remodel it, and they put a beautiful walking area with flowers around it. So that place of disturbance became a place of peace, because now we did our walking meditation on this cool hardscape with these beautiful flowers around it.
Nice, nice.
Yeah.
Very nice. There's, it reminds me of a story that Ram Dass tells of having a sitting group, meditation group in New York City on top of a fire station. And they, you know, sometimes they'd be meditating and suddenly the to be a fire, right, or something, and then the sirens go off, the trucks go off, and, you know. And apparently at first people are upset. You know, how could you do this? And it's terrible for a meditation. But over time, the meditators got to appreciate the kundalini rising or the, or the way that it got made them very present. And you know, it's, you know, the idea of that we get disturbed is only a function of that we have other ideas of what's supposed to be happening. So maybe sometimes we look at those ideas and maybe it doesn't have to be a disturbance. Okay. So